Number one, Star Wars. Number two, comics. Number three, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Number four, Mario. Number five, Weird Al. Number six, Batman. Number seven, Kal-El. Number eight, The Simpsons. Number nine, TV. Number ten, every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out, say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Nerds Ruin Everything. I'm Logan.
And I'm Adam.
And it's going to be a probably hodgepodge mishmash. Who knows what today? Because I really haven't had a chance to see much of anything.
So. Yeah. I mean, I've seen some stuff, but it's all like in prep for Oscar. Kind of like the Oscar catch-up. Ketchup. Not mustard, but ketchup. fuck. I will say this much. I watched Poor Things last night. And
I thought about it. Like, it just hit Hulu, right?
Yes.
Like, it just 2 days ago?
Yeah, 2 days ago. It was, like, on the 7th, right? And I was like, thank God I found out, because we were going to watch it last weekend when it debuted on, like, Premiere VOD. And I was like, and then I saw something. They were like, yeah, you know, like I have like one of those like Hulu, what's coming to streaming.
Yeah.
And thank God I checked it. Like I checked their feed because they were like, you know, Poor Things coming March 7th, like a week later. Right. And I'm like, I can wait and save myself $20.
Yeah.
It's fucking wild, dude. Like that is the first movie. That's the first movie in a long time that threw me for a loop that I was like, like, at the end of it, I'm like, I truly don't know what I think of this movie. Like, its moral compass is all over the fucking place.
That's Yorgos Lanthimos, like, to a T, though.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's like, I haven't felt like this since Dogtooth. Like, Dogtooth really threw me for a loop, because at first I thought I hated that movie. But I've come to really love that movie a lot. Like, it's probably in my top 20. Like, that's how good Dogtooth is. But it's also that shockingness and like the central, like the pro, like Dogtooth, the central conceit of it, which is kind of a spoiler but kind of not, it threw me for a loop and it kept on like giving me right hooks. And I'm not sure if I'm fairly certain that Yorgos meant this to be kind of in your face, and I now know why Emma Stone, not Thompson. there's so many damn Emmas. The reason why Stone agreed to it beyond like working with Yorgos, because you know, I mean, and she could very well get a second Oscar out of this. Like, I'm not sure after seeing that performance and between her and Lily Gladstone, I honestly don't know. But the central conceit is so like it kept in my head so much that the nudity and the sex of it all, and there is a lot of sex, guys. Like, this is a thirsty fucking film. Like, this is like, but not in like the best way possible. It's like 1800s weirdness.
Yeah.
like thirstiness. And the thing was that I just every time sex came up, every time sexuality was an issue in this movie, the central conceit kept on coming back to me. Like, do you know what it is? Do you know like what the big to do with who Bella Baxter is, or like the Emma Stone character?
I think so, because I've heard so many discussions, but I'm honestly not sure.
Okay, do you mind? I mean, because happens in the first, like, 5 seconds. Or the first, like, literally, okay. So, the central conceit of the movie is that the Willem Dafoe character is, like, a Frankenstein, like scientist in a steampunk version of our world in the 1800s.
I didn't know that.
Okay, yeah. So the movie opens with the woman that becomes Bella Baxter, the Emma Stone character, pregnant, and commits suicide, jumps off the London Bridge. And then he finds her. She is not alive, but her 8.5-month-old fetus is. He cuts the fetus out and then exchanges the brain of the infant into the grown woman.
So she's literally like
a newborn. Yeah. A newborn. While all of this, like, the Mark Ruffalo character, has sex with her, absconds her away, on a vacation of sex and food, ends up as a prostitute. I know, Rip. I love that we have a third co-host now. Like, I don't know if you guys know, but Ripley has become our third unofficial co-host of this podcast, which, you know, she's right about this. Like, you know, it's kind of fucking weird because, like, and the thing is that this is, like, I thought that I knew how much sex and nudity was going to be in this fucking movie, but I did not.
Yeah.
And that central conceit kept on bouncing around in my brain is that because this only takes place over a few months, I think maybe 6 months to a year, right? And it just keeps on, like I don't know whether it was super effective for me. I feel like it is because Yorgos is not the kind of guy that just makes a plot point and then just lets it out. Like, I think that it was meant to be this, and I think that that's the reason why Stone took the part, because every time, like, if you have a good moral compass and you're a pretty smart film cineast, you should instantly recognize, whoa, what is going on here? Like literally all of these guys, like, it's kind of funny because it's a critique of manhood and the male gaze in a way, because all of these guys don't stop for a second to realize that this only Rami Youssef's character, who's brilliant in the movie, by the way. Like, I feel like that would be your, like, if anything comes out of this, it'll just be your confirmation of how good Rami Youssef is. Like, yeah. You being on the early train of the Rami Youssef, like, train, right? Like, you being in first class. Like, this would just confirm that because he's so fucking wonderful in this movie. And he's kind of, like, the only, like, between him and Willem Dafoe's character. But even then, William Dafoe's character, why do you create a child? Like, you know, why do you create this just because you can? But anywho, it's a very, very, like, and it's also visually in your face. So it takes a lot of, like, at the end of it, it was like 11 o'clock at night. And I was like, okay, wow, that's a lot in my head pinging around. Because it doesn't, like, it's not a subtle film. Like anything like Yorgos does, right? Like,
yeah.
Like the Favorite is not like this. Like, what I love about The Favorite is that it's a costume drama that's, like, priggish and piggish, and like, it tells this really kind of, like, infantile story of a woman who's just sex crazed and is pitting her two female lovers against one another. And it's not like it's bawdy, right? It's like, it's kind of like, it's not gross, but it definitely feels like, oh, okay, this is probably how it really was. And that's the kind of way that it kind of is. It's kind of in your face. Like, I guess Ruffalo's, like, comedic genius. Like, his, like the where he goes and what he does with it. Like, I was completely, you know how, like Ruffalo is just Ruffalo? Like, he's kind of funny in bits and starts, but here he's full out, like, from the moment that you see this creepy son of a bitch, like, it's both funny and terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, you can see that, like, in the trailer. I'm just like, what is he doing? Like, what, like, who is he playing? Because this seems very not Ruffalo as of late, at least. So
it's he got off the Jesus complex cross. And he just got started to get dirty in this. Like, it really feels like, you know how, like we've been watching Robert Downey and then we'd see him in Oppenheimer and you snap your fingers and you go, like, and I didn't mean that as a, like, a pun, but you snap your fingers and you go, fuck, that's the Robert Downey Jr. I remember from the 80s.
Yeah.
This is like snapping your fingers and going, fuck, I didn't know Mark Ruffalo was that funny, but he's that fucking funny. Wow, okay. We've gotten put into this Marvel MCU Academy Award nominated series. They knew like performance stuff, and he's kind of gotten to this weird he went back to like weird quirky indie, but he's actually funny. It's not like 13 going on 30 where you're like, he's not funny. Like, he was just cast because Jennifer Gardner had a kind of a crush on him, but like, he's actually funny. Like that, like the funniest moments, and I was cackling, was like when Bella's attention, or like the Emma Stone's character's attention, is churned from him. And what a little like weaselly, like cry man baby, like shit he becomes, and the things that he does. It's like, he's the villain, but he has no, like, he's like, he's the villain in the way that he thinks he's smart. But the funniest part about the movie is how, like, Yorgos takes him and slowly turns him into this imbecile that is not as smart as a six-month-old child. Like that's literally, like, she gets him at every corner and corners him into, like, these places that he didn't realize that somebody could put him into. And it's just, like, the reaction of this man who thought he could control this woman. And it sounds dark, and it is, but it's really funny because it's really kind of Mark Ruffalo going, like, full-on stupid. Like, he's really stupid in the movie. Like, you know how, like, there's sometimes where people are fake stupid and they wink and nod? And they go, oh, yeah, I'm playing stupid. But then there's, like, the Coen. Like, we've talked about the Coen brothers stupid, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's Coen brothers stupid in this movie. And, like, that's kind of the brilliance of the movie, like, is it's kind of like Kubrick meets Coen brothers, if that's, like, possible. It's the dialogue rich of the Coen brothers and their ability to, like, create characters that are smart in certain respects, but truly dumb in others. But then that visual splendor that Kubrick can bring. So, yeah, it was interesting. Like, it's definitely going to give me food for thought. I would really love to have a conversation with you once you've seen it. Like, I don't care how it pulls out on the Oscars. It's just as much of an interesting movie regardless.
Oh, yeah. It's probably the only film, like, in the Oscar race that I haven't seen, which is, I haven't seen many of them. It's the only one that I'm, like, I'm actually interested in seeing. I haven't seen a ton of Yorgos Lanthimos, but, like, it's kind of like, it's not in the same way that, like, Nolan or Shyamalan, where you're just like, oh, I kind of know, like, you can look at it and go, yeah, they're going to try to pull something over on us. But, like, I understand enough about, like, what he does to know, like, it's at least going to be interesting. So yes, it's one that's been on my radar for, I mean, since it came out, and I just, you know, couldn't make it to the theater to see it. So
me either.
And now that it's on Hulu, I'm like, yeah, I got to catch up with that. I just didn't have time this week.
All good, man. All good. Like I just probably just confirmed, like, the kind of things that you were thinking that you, like, it was just make you want to see it more. Yeah, so I would definitely say put that one up there. It's an experience and a half. You may not like it. Like I said, like, I'm not even sure I like it. But that's the kind of film I love, is like a movie that I'm like, sure that I like this?
Which one is the one where the dad has kept the girls, like, away from basically, like, everything?
Oh, that's the one. Oh God, what is that? It's with what's his name? Oh God. Are you talking about the one with good grief, I can't think of his name. Hold on a second. Is it the one with Viggo where he plays, like, the weird father?
I think so.
Captain, like, what is it called? Captain Fantastic? Is that the one you're thinking of? One where he has, like...
It might be Dogtooth that I'm thinking of.
Okay, because... okay, wait. Yeah, Dogtooth is the one where he has the two daughter... Like, the two daughters are... The two daughters and the son are kept away from the world, and he's basically the father's. That's Dogtooth.
I was kind of in the same boat as you were. It's like, I don't know if I like this movie. And then, like, as I got away from it, I was like, that's so interesting. And then I never saw, didn't he make the one, not the Americanized version with Will Ferrell, but was it Will Ferrell? Where the guy...
Oh, Force Majeure?
Yeah.
That's a different guy. That's the guy who did Triangle Sadness. He did Killing of Sacred Deer with Barry Keoghan and Colin Farrell and Nicole Kidman.
That's right.
Yeah. Another one I was not sure of when I got out of the the screening that I saw that on, and I'm still not sure. Yeah. But I know it's good. Like that's the weird thing. Like those are those kinds of movies where it's like, I don't like, there's some movies that are very easy to like kind of like cage into like a box, right? But his films feel like they're not like really, even like his, like The Favorite, which is like this huge Oscar movie, right? It doesn't fit into a box where you're like, oh yeah, I really like that movie. It's like, I respect it, but damn, what the hell, this movie. It's definitely like one of those movies that I probably like. I find that at like the end of it all, I feel like I'm going to probably think about this movie for decades to come. And it'll come to me in my head. Oh, yeah. You remember that time that Emma Stone played that infant and Mark Ruffalo played that pervert that took her away and just fucked her away and she became a prostitute? That movie was wild. That kind of thing where it's like, it's just one of those movies where you just kind of like go, oh shit. Okay. This is because it's a studio movie, you don't expect it to have these kinds of thoughts about things. Like the one thing I will respect about Dune 2 is that it does definitely lean into the politics of it all and what a messiah is and not just the good things, but the really bad things about a messiah. And people that are just blindly following them. I will say that much. But it's not like this movie where it's like, oh shit, this movie got away with a lot of stuff. And I think that all the studio executives saw were Emma Stone, nudity. Like that's all they saw. Like they just saw Emma Stone, nudity, and they were just like, those pervy fucking executives like just like kind of like rubbed their hands together. Oh, we're gonna get a nudie movie with Emma Stone. Yeah, we'll get to see lots of like just the most disgusting, crass like thoughts. Like I can only imagine that's what they thought. But because
she's been championing like his work really for a while, and they've got a whole kind of like working relationship now, and she's on this like new career path that's so interesting, where it's just like, oh, Emma Stone has zero fucks left to give. She's just doing whatever she finds interesting.
Absolutely. And you know what I think the movie that did that to her, like honestly, I think was Zombieland 2. Like having to do Zombieland 2, being forced into it by a contract. And also, like, if you think about it, that's like the demarcation line, right? Because after that, like, it just seems like all she's doing is like different movies and not like the conventional studio movies.
So what you're saying is we're about to see the most interesting version of Dakota Johnson we ever thought we could see.
You know what? I would not put it past her after this fucking bullshit. I honestly, like, I mean, and you know, it's not like Dakota Johnson isn't a talented person, right? I mean, Madame Web fucked her up. Like, if you really think about it, like, let's go back and do a post, like another version 3 of a conversation about Madame Web. But if you really think about it, like, from the get-go, this is like a bad thing for her, right? Like, she took the movie because she knew it was going to be bad. But I don't think that she realized how bad it was going to be and how much she would have to go on tour and not do an apology tour, but just kind of do this whole, like, yeah, I was in the movie. It's terrible. I don't know Spider-Man movies. I don't know how, like, the weirder part is that, is she playing up to the bullshit? Like, does she really not know Harry Potter movies and Spider-Man movies?
I mean, she might not, but she could also just be fucking with us. So
yeah, seriously. Like it's weird because, like,
the Spider-Man stuff, I get. Harry Potter, I mean, I don't know. I guess I could see not knowing all the names of the Harry Potter movies, but just being like, well, I mean, yeah, and it's boy wizard. Yeah, like, yeah, whatever. But yeah, I mean, maybe it really just is not her thing, you know?
It's
but
true. I mean, yeah, you're right. But
if she doesn't, I mean, it's, you know, I don't know. It's funny watching her do that stuff. And, like, I feel like if she's being truthful, like, if that she's in on the joke, too. Like, she's not, like, seriously going, like, yeah, Spider-Man and the, like, whatever, you know. She's smiling. Like, she knows she's not getting it right. And she just doesn't care. Which kind of just makes it way more charming, you know?
No, it really does. It really does. And it's her deadpan, right? Like, for me, it's always her weird, like, her mom and her dad were never as deadpan as she is, right? Yeah. Like, I've never seen, like we were around when Melanie Griffith was a thing, right? Like, in the mid-80s to the mid-90s, like, she was a bankable star. Like, I think she's one of those forgotten stars, right? Like, everybody remembers Demi Moore because she's still hot and, like, you know, still her children are fucking a mess, a train wreck. And then, you know, her weirdly nonspecific relationship with Bruno is kind of amazing. I kind of love it. Like, that she's, like, that they're still co-parenting. And especially more so since the illness, the diagnosis, but, like, she was, like, a fucking star. Like, Don Johnson, her dad was a fucking star. Like, those two were a power couple, and they, like, him on TV, her in film, like, it never swapped the other way, because Johnson, unfortunately, never got the shot at, like, I mean, he was a TV actor at the time when TV actors didn't make the transition, right?
Right.
You know, it's
Bruce
funny
Willis
that
was the rare first exception. Like, I mean, probably not since Clint Eastwood had somebody gone from television to film in such a spectacular fashion.
No, absolutely. And both were unintentional superstars. Like, Die Hard was not meant to be. Like, Fox had an indication.
I mean, it wasn't even for Bruce Willis. He was, like, the third, like, well, I guess we're going with this guy.
Yeah, well, I love that their top choice was Frank Sinatra. It's like, what? Well, you thought that Frank Sinatra at 60 was going to do this shit?
Okay, so it's not that he was their top choice. That's true. He was the first choice because he had been involved. So, I know way too much about this. All right. So, because it's funny because Bruce Willis's very first on-screen credit is in a Frank Sinatra movie.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So Frank Sinatra was in a movie written, based off a book written by the same guy that wrote the book that Die Hard was based off of.
Yes,
they're in a series about a specific character. Mm-hmm. And so Sinatra had, like, some kind of contractual thing. And they were like, well, I guess Frank Sinatra's going to be in this. Like, that was the thing. And he was like, no, guys, no. Like, he was 60 something at the time. And then their second choice was who was it? Shit, now I can't remember. But yeah, Bruce Willis was like third or fourth choice. They went to like several other people, and nobody wanted to do it, because it on paper, I guess, seems kind of dumb. Like, especially at that time. Like, oh, yeah, it's just a big, like, you know, goofy, like, action movie. But, like, there just wound up being so much more to it. I mean, launched Bruce Willis into absolute superstardom. He could do whatever he wanted after that, as evidenced by Hudson Hawk.
Yeah, seriously. Like I mean, the funniest part is the choices made after Die Hard became this instant hit and this instant classic were wild. Like, you look at his stuff before he got his bearings and had to go back to the, like, the reason why Die Hard 2 exists is because he did so fucking terribly with his choices post Die Hard, right? Yeah. Like, I'm not saying this to be cute. Like, you literally look at his, like, okay, so he has, okay, so, like, he does Die Hard, right? But, like, you know, after that, like, other than Look Who's Talking, where he's a voice, right? He's a voice, the same like he does Look Who's Talking too, but he does In Country, Bonfires of the Vanities, Mortal Thoughts, Hudson Hawk. Like, he does a Billy Bathgate. He does these movies that, like, literally don't add up to anything. Like, Mortal Thoughts is actually a really good movie. Like, if you've ever seen it, it's a really good, really dark movie. Same with In Country. I think that we weren't ready.
All of those are 1991 is Mortal Thoughts, Hudson Hawk, Billy Bathgate.
Yep.
And The Last Boy Scout.
Last Boy Scout, yeah.
I mean, which was not a hit. In 1991. Mm-hmm. But Last Boy Scout is fantastic, man.
Oh, yeah. It may have not been a hit, but it's funny because, I mean, you know, I still remember watching it when I was a kid because of, like, you know, Bruce, I mean, who didn't want, like, at the time,
we watched, like, everything that Bruce Willis did.
Yes.
Like, my dad would come home, I got the new Bruce Willis movie. And, I mean, they're like, I honestly watched, like, Bonfire of the Vanities as, like, in 91 or so. I would have been, what, 12, 13? So, like, as a very young teenager, I watched that movie, and, I mean, I thought it was fucking stupid. Like, I could probably watch it now and really appreciate what it's trying to say. But, yeah, as a 13, 14-year-old, I was like, what the fuck is this? Like, it's not a Bruce Willis movie. He's not shooting anybody. You know, but, so, like, I would love to revisit, like, some of those early failures because, you know, they were probably just failures because, you know, it was the play the hits thing, right? Like, we don't want to hear your new shit. Play the old shit.
But then, like, I feel like, for me, the apex of Bruce Willis is 94 because it's Pulp, North, Color of Night, and Nobody's Fool. Right, like
Color of Night's a highly underrated film.
It is because, like, I don't think that anybody got it was supposed to be melodramatic. You know, it was supposed to be kind of like this version of a psychosexual thriller. Which, let's just take a moment to appreciate. Like, we will probably never get an era of psychosexual thrillers again because of all these kids that say there's too much sex in movies, to which I always go, what are you talking about? Like, I lived through the 90s. I know psychosexual thrillers. Like, I know how much nudity there was. And you guys are talking about, like, you guys are all like, you know, Basic Instincts at the top, the tip of the iceberg, whereas, like, Color of Night is, like, midway through. It's like half Skinamax, half respectable movie. Right. But I mean, in that kind of, like, thing, it finds this perfect middle ground. I fucking love that movie. And then Nobody's Fool. I mean, one of the last like great late era Paul Newman films. And then Pulp Fiction. I mean, we've talked about Pulp Fiction at length. Like, it's one of those movies where it's just like they say, you know, well, we need a star, like in the indie boom. Like, we need a star. If we want to, like, you know, Quentin, if you want to make this crazy-ass movie, we need a star. You need a star? Fuck you, Bruno, right there. And he literally does the thing that you need a star to do in an indie movie. He shows up in the middle of the movie, and he's, like, the focus in the middle of the movie. He has the, I mean, I feel like he has the best section. Like, I like, the older I get, the more I feel like Butch's boxing set, like, the whole Misadventures of Butch is, like, the best part of that movie. Because it's, like, a tradition, it's, like, a mini movie inside of movies, and it does exactly what you want it to do. Like, it takes you on a twist and turny adventure. I still remember the moment in the theater, like, opening night, seeing Pulp Fiction, and when Butch grabs the samurai sword and unsheaths it, the crowd, the packed crowd I was in, the noise that they made, you would have thought that Rocky had just knocked out Ivan Drago. Like, it was wild, right? Like, but, I mean, yeah. I mean, we continually talk about Bruno, and I love him, and, like, I'm glad that he's, like, he's being taken care of. At least it appears that he's being taken care of by his entire family. Regardless of the shit he was during some of his more infamous times as a superstar. I mean, you know, it's like, man, the man could do it. And once he found his, like, it felt like after Pulp Fiction, he found his groove, right? Because then he goes on this run where he does, like, weird shit, but he also does the superstar shit, and it's like, it all works. Like, you know, it's like, I think about, like, his cameo stuff, right? Like North is basically a cameo, right? Because he's playing the narrator. Beavis and Butthead. Like,
yeah.
Were you, like, did you see Beavis and Butthead in the theater?
I think so. I mean, it would have been, like, prime, like, me going to the movies as that age with my friends. And, of course,
yeah,
Beavis and Butthead was a huge thing for us. So,
yeah.
I imagine I saw it in the theater, but I don't know. I've definitely seen it.
No, of course. But it's, like, weird because, like, I think about it, and, like, the trailers, until the movie came out and it was a couple of weeks in, they kept that a secret. So, like, when I went, I remember seeing it, it was like, it's the thing, like, when you see somebody in a movie and you don't really believe they're in the movie, like, well, this is like a voice cameo, and you hear it and you go, is that fucking Bruce Willis? Oh, shit, that's Bruce Willis.
And Demi Moore. Demi Moore.
Yeah, like, it's like, it's crazy. Like, it's kind of interesting to really think about, like, how effective he was for a long time. And one of the biggest, like, you know, of the three, I think that he's my favorite, like, of the three, even though I feel like Stallone of the three, he has the best movies.
Yeah.
Because I'll make an argument that Rocky and First Blood are, like, even bigger than Terminator T2. There are, like, they're milestones that, like, you look at, and they change the directions of things. Yeah. But, well, I don't know.
I mean, when you think, like, if you look at Bruce Willis's, like, and of course, a lot of those movies, especially in the last 15 years, are like, I don't even know what this is. But 2024 will be the first year Bruce Willis has not had a movie released at all since 1988. You know, I mean,
and that's weird, right? Like, super weird to think about.
That's a crazy run. Of course, not all of those were released in theaters, but I mean, over three decades, four decades, to have a movie that you're starring in, or at least are in, coming out at least one every single year. Like, that's crazy, man. You know?
It really is. It really is. Like, it, and like things that people are going to see, like his, like I know since about 2019, it's all been direct to video. But if you think about it, like people are still watching those fucking movies because it's Bruce fucking Willis that's in it, right?
I mean, if it pops up on your like Netflix or Prime or whatever, like, oh hey, a Bruce Willis movie, like you know. So little left turn. The last two episodes of Death and Other Details dropped this week, which I was a little upset that they dropped both the episodes until I watched them, because by the time you get to the end of the ninth episode, if you didn't get to watch the 10th episode, you'd be a little pissed.
Wow, that's a hell of a cliffhanger then. That's a hell of a cliffhanger.
It is what I hoped Now You See Me would have been.
Also,
I saw the news this week that apparently they're working on another Now You See Me movie. Yeah. Now You See Me is probably the most upsetting movie I've ever seen in my life. Because I spent the entire film just going like, bullshit. Like, none of this makes any sense. But anyway, we'll talk about that movie. This show does a lot of what Now You See Me did, though. Like, in the last two episodes, where you're like, wait, so all the stuff I thought was happening might not have been the case? Like, you're kind of misled. You've had an unreliable narrator in the form of the director or the writers. It's got some shock to it that's very head scratching. Like, I don't know if it all lines up and makes sense. They do the explain away thing. But it's still pretty good. Definitely surprising. I was a half a step ahead of a lot of it by the time. It's hard to talk about without, because I definitely do not. I think the show is worthwhile. I think everybody should watch it. Okay. It's definitely a surprise who the I don't want to say big bad, but I don't know another word for it. But the villain of the piece is definitely a surprise. And like, the reveal is pretty great. But after the reveal, I was about half a step ahead of, like, I was like, oh, I wonder if it's this. And then they'd say, oh, yeah, it's this. And so it's not quite as clever as it thinks it is once the big reveal happens. But though, the one thing I'll say about the two-part finale, they exit Mandy Patinkin out of the last two episodes for reasons. Not killed. But the character exits, and there's a reason why, and it's fine, but the show is a lot less without him. Like, you're like, oh, this dude was doing a lot of lifting for this. It's still really entertaining, but not as much.
Oh, man. I hate when that happens. Like, I really honestly do. Like, I hate when, like, they decide to take away the person that wasn't the star, but the one that made the move, like, made the movie or the show what it was, but you didn't realize it because they, like, until it actually happens. And when it does, it kind of deflates just enough for you to realize it and be disappointed. Like, those are the most frustrating things, because it's like, it's still good. It's just, it goes from great to good. Well, and that
he does the he does the Columbo type thing so well in this show, where every time somebody's talking and he's not in the scene specifically. You're just waiting for him to walk into the scene and go, well, you know, really, it's like this, you know, and kind of just explain things or just be a little pompous or. So the like he can't do that for most of the last two episodes. And so you're just like, oh, it's just these people. And like half of them or over half of them are portraying like rich assholes who and I've spent eight episodes not liking these people.
Yeah. Oh, man.
But it's still a really, really worthwhile murder mystery. It has room for more if they want to do more. So that was nice because I thought, oh, they're just going to completely wrap this up. There won't be anything else. And then right at the end, it's like, but maybe something else. So. Yeah, I hope he does more because I really, really enjoy him in this part. So, and
I mean, anytime you get Mandy Patinkin, right? It's one of those things that it's like he like, and also it's funny because he honestly feels like if they're gonna do, I know this sounds weird, but if they're gonna do a final villain at the end of Only Murderers. It almost seems fitting, like it would have to be somebody like Mandy Patinkin.
I would love to see those two go head to head.
Oh yeah,
absolutely love it.
Yeah, like it would be. It feels like that, right? Like, it's definitely on my list now that it's finished. It's past the finish line. I definitely have it because, I mean, you know, like, I love a good mystery show, and especially one like this, right? That's kind of like, this one is taking, it sounds like, a little bit more of an adult approach to things, because, like you said, it's kind of horny and kind of thirsty, and I kind of like that. I like it a lot, actually.
It very much starts out that way until, like, a lot of people start dying, then that becomes less of the, like, oh, we don't have time. Like, there's somebody killing people on this boat. We gotta figure it out. Didn't you tell me that you watched Animal Control?
Yes, I watched the first season, and I know that the second season is back. I really enjoyed it. Like once it found its ground and once it found its footing, because for the first three episodes, I did not like it.
Yeah, it's really rough those first few episodes. It's like, mm-hmm. I'm kind of just here for the Joel McHale smarmy, like, shit. Because the rest of it is a little rough, man. But then, like, everybody kind of just settles into what they're doing. And it gets a little more playful, a little more interesting and certainly funnier. I think season two, I watched the premiere, it picks up more or less where they left off. I'm really, really interested in, like, can this show do anything? Like, it's on a network that doesn't really value what it's doing. So, like, well, if this were a streaming show, absolutely. But if Fox doesn't care. Like, no, if you're Fox... not animated Sunday night content, they really don't give a shit.
Well, yeah. And okay, so, like, there's three things that they, like, there's, like, Fox cares about, like, there's, like, four things they care about, right? They care about Sunday night animation, they care about their football, and then they care about whatever Ryan Murphy thing that they're able to, like, beg out of him, aka 911, whatever all the cop shows that he has all of his people that he wants to, like, all of his family. And trust me, guys, I'm all for Ryan Murphy getting people paid, like, getting actors that have been respected, aka Angela Bassett. Like, if you want to make Angela Bassett and Rob Lowe like superstars and get them paid, I'm all for it. Go for it. Go right ahead. Like, it's all good. But just don't expect me to watch it. Because it's really like, I don't know. It's kind of crass. Like, it's kind of like, just like, I don't know. It really feels like, do you know what it feels like? Like, whenever I've seen one of those episodes of those 911 shows, cause I think there's two of them. There's the Texas one that Rob Lowe stars in, which I giggle at the fact that Rob Lowe is
in a show in Texas.
Texas. Like, that's Ryan Murphy for you. Like, I feel like Ryan Murphy is just the middle finger, the gay man that's pointing the middle finger at middle America and saying, ha ha, I'm fooling you and making you give me all the money for my liberal causes. Fuck you. And that's literally 911 Lone Star. But I've watched it, and you know what it is? He literally took, like, the cop shows from the 70s and 80s, like Chips, and just repurposed it. That's all it is.
So, what? I can't believe we're getting off on a tangent about this stuff. Here's what. Yeah. So I do not watch those shows. Yeah. But what was most interesting to me is, like, yes, Ryan Murphy. But, like, if you look at the shows have three creators, mm-hmm. Brad Falchuk, Tim Minear, and Ryan Murphy. Now, Tim Minear's been around for a while, and like, he was a Whedon guy, but the more you hear about Whedon, the more you're like, was Tim Minear the thing that worked for those shows?
Yep. No, absolutely. Well, I mean, all you need to do is look at his filmography and just realize, like, yeah, he was a big part of those shows. But yes, you are 100% right.
Brad Falchuk, though, has The Brother's Son on Netflix now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm really, really interested in seeing. Now, him and Ryan Murphy go back like forever and a day, I think.
Yes, they do.
So,
yeah. Nip Tuck and Glee days, they overlapped, and I mean, you know, like, it's kind of funny. Like, isn't it weird to think that, like, Ryan Murphy was not Ryan Murphy even during, like, Nip Tuck Glee era? Like, it took American Horror Story to really turn him
into... It's so bizarre. Because, like, to me, like, when people say Ryan Murphy, like, I know everybody thinks American Horror Story now, but I'm like, oh, yeah, Nip Tuck guy. Because, like, that was the show I watched. And I was like, who is this Ryan Murphy guy? Like, he's got a specific kind of aesthetic for, like, just being able to tell fucking weird stories in weird ways, you know, and not be pigeonholed. Cause like almost like every season in Nip Tuck was weird in its own way.
It really was like, that show is fucking wild in the way that it pushed boundaries on TV. Like, I still remember, like, just like the thing that I always found weird was the gore and the nudity. And then all of a sudden, if you were watching it on live TV, the commercials, like, it would always throw me. Cause it was like, that wasn't supposed to happen. Like the amount of it, like, yeah, you know, NYPD Blue had like nudity in it. But it was so brief. Like, it was so brief that it could have been, like, even nowadays, you watch, if you ever watch that show, it's positively PG-13 in the way that it approaches it. Sorry, bless me. But that show had to walk or had to crawl before, like, something like Nip Tuck can run. Because, I mean, like, I still think about that. I'm like, yeah, Nip Tuck is still, like, one of those shows that, like, it was, like, when it said TVMA, it meant TVMA.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Like, this was before streaming. Like, this was DVD, TV DVD era, where, like, you know, like, I think the first season I watched on DVD, because, like, like, my favorite part about that era was they timed it perfectly, the DVD TV release boxes, to when the premiere would happen. Like, it was always a month before. So, like, if you were behind, you had your chance to watch the entire season on DVD and be there in time for the premiere of the next season. So there was always never a, like, you always had, you could catch up. It just took a monetary investment, which I always found humorous that now we just wait for streaming and then watch them all whole, or even watch them the next day. But yeah, all three of those guys, like, if you really think about it, are, like, were heavy hitters before, but I feel like them combining together their specific talents, because we all know Manier's the guy that's a director, right? Like, he's, like, the guy that puts things together to make it what it is. I mean, he did so, like, if you read about the oral histories of Firefly, you can see how much, like, everybody talks about it and not.
Yeah, like, it was such a, like, oh, Whedon. And then, like, now I look at him, like, this is Ben Edlin and Tim Minear's show.
Yes, it really is. Like, especially the voice of it is Edlin's show. Like, the visuals are Minear, right? Like, you watch it and you go, like, and, like, we just talked about style, and I know that a lot of people think that TV doesn't have, like, a style to it, but if you watch enough TV from specific storytellers, you start to get an idea that there is a style there. And Minear has a very specific action drama-oriented style. But Edlin has that voice, right? Like, it was never, like, it's weird because you think about it and you go, yeah, Firefly is not Whedon. It's literally Edlin writing what he wanted to write. And, like, you know, of course, as in true late 90s, early 2000s glory, one dude takes all the glory of it. Like, it's not a collaborative effort, right? It's Joss Whedon in his ascension to whatever what eventually ended up being the Avengers.
Well, I think I started getting a sense for Minear, like, as a voice, and not just being Whedon. Ben Edlin, I knew, but, like, I knew who Ben Edlin was because
I
come from comics. So, well, I fucking love The Tick. So, but Minear, like, after Firefly, came on as a producer for a Brian Fuller show that didn't last called Wonder Falls. And I was like, oh, this guy, like, he has a creative voice as well. Now, Wonder Falls is very much a Brian Fuller show, but you can kind of see the things going on there, you know? But anyway, yeah, going all the way back. Hey, I don't know why. Stop. Nope. Come here. Are you going to bark at me and then not come over here? I swear. Crazy dog. So she's literally sitting on my bed looking at me, barking at me.
Oh,
like,
man.
What are you doing? but yeah, the 911 of it all being like these three guys just being like, what if we did this? Like, yeah, it's like literally having coffee, you know, like quote taking a meeting with each other. Even though, I mean, they'd all basically worked together before, but, you know, just sitting around going like, what should we do? I don't know. What if we did like one of those 70s style, like, cop shows? So.
Yeah. And let's just cast, like, let's cast a combination of, like former stars. Like, cause I mean, like, let's be honest. Like, Rob Lowe has like, he's had like, what, four or five different reinventions since his Bad Boy days.
He's one of the few people probably like that's had more shots, more bites at the apple than Robert Downey Jr. It's just
absolutely.
Good Lord, like, man.
like if Marvel was thinking about, like, if it came out, like even though it didn't, but if it ever came out that Rob Lowe and Robert Downey Jr. were the last two people for Iron Man, you could see it. because of their, like, their similar trajectories, their similar kind of aura, even though Lo is a little bit more subdued. But if you were wanting to do that and not the mania, the Tasmanian devil that is RDJ, like, you could see it, right? Like, yeah. Rob Lowe is that guy that, like, you know, like his contemporaries, like Tom Cruise, Robert Downey Jr., like, you know, like Tom Hanks. I mean, he was in that, like, in that section. Like, that's what I always find humorous, is that this man is like...
Yeah, Tom Hanks, like, is another TV guy that went big in the movies. I forgot about that.
But the asterisk behind him was that he was never on a popular show other than Bosom Buddies.
Yeah.
And it took him a long time. I mean, remember, like, we always used to make jokes about him because he was just the funny dude, right? Because he was the funny dude from Dragnet and The Burbs. And we all kind of knew that those were big movies, but they weren't giant. They weren't like his Gary Cooper run, right? Or his Jimmy Stewart run that he did that started with Philadelphia and then just kind of got bigger and bigger. And then he just became Tom Hanks, you know? Yeah. But like, Lo is like 60 and he still looks like about our age.
It's
like,
crazy, man.
That's the fucking crazy part about it. And he runs a game show too. They gave him a fucking game show that I'm inclined to watch. The Floor? I don't know what it's about. I'm fairly certain it's about people that, like, guess wrong things and they get dropped through the floor. but he's like, and then he did his Netflix show, the one with his son.
Yeah,
like,
which I think is getting a second season. I think they confirmed. Yeah.
Yeah, they confirmed it. But it's like funny to me that, like, you make a show for Rob Lowe, right? But you make him the most, it's like, so, like, it's funny because, like, I know people who watch that show, so they've told me about it. It's like, it's the most Rob Lowe character. He's an ex-New York City fire.
Ryan loved those shows. Love those shows.
And I don't even, like, you know, it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, I'm not even mad at him. Like, Ryan, like the one thing I always loved about Ryan and I appreciated is that whenever there was a show that he watched or something that he said, he put out into the ether, like, the thing was that eventually that fucking thing would end up being something really big. Like, he had that taste for something where if he saw something and he liked it, eventually it would become a big thing.
With music, too. It used to piss me off, man. Like, because, you know, we worked together at the pizza place for years and years and years and years, man. Like, he would come in. It would be like a year or more before shit would break. But, like, I remember him coming in and playing Maroon 5. And I was like, what is this? He was like, it's this band called Maroon 5. I was like, it's all right, man. And then, like, 9 months later, that shit's on the radio. And I'm like, and it's all over the radio, like, nonstop. I'm like, I don't want to hear this anymore, man. Same thing with Imagine Dragons, dude. Like, he's like, man, you got to listen to this band, Imagine Dragons. I'm like, yeah, that's pretty good. And then, you know, like, 8 months later, I can't stop hearing Waking Up. Like, I'm just like, oh, my God, man. Like, I'm so tired of hearing this song. And they're like, oh, like, it just hit number one. I'm like, I was listening to it 8 months ago.
And then Ryan's like, I was listening to it a year ago. Yeah. Like, fuck y'all. Fuck y'all. I knew this was going to be the shit. But, like, he always had great taste. Like, I like, that's what I love. Like, it was always, like, it always perked me up whenever he, like, would do a Facebook post, right, about something that he was watching. And just knew. I was like, oh, okay, well, this is going to be a big hit. I should actually check it out just to see what. And it was always like he had that feel, like, you know, like Blum, like Jason Blum has that feel for commercial things. He kind of had that feel of like, oh, yeah, that's going to be huge. And some even like, it wasn't even like he was doing it for that. He had good taste. And it's all a way of saying he had like really good populist taste. And it's like, I mean, he was never wrong. Like, he was never wrong about something that he posted about. Like, I can't think of things that he did that weren't like, oh, yeah, that's awesome. And they, or, I mean, I like it, but that thing is fucking huge. Yeah. Like, now. And, you know, just the way he was. Like, it, It's one of the things that I really liked about him and appreciated about him is that he had impeccable taste, which,
yeah, it was annoying. You know. It was great, probably great from afar. It got annoying when you were with it all the time.
You had that self-sat, like, let's be honest, yeah. He had that self-satisfied, attitude about it, too. Like, I know that. I listened to enough of your podcast to, like, he set something out, and then a couple of months later, it would come back, and you just hear it in his voice. Like, but it was, like, the best kind, like, Ryan, like at his best, I always felt like was when he was that kind of self-satisfied, because it never was annoying. It was probably a little annoying to his brother, but it was always fun because it was always like, oh man,
there's a reason why sitting in a hospital bed watching the first 3 minutes of some show that, like, I was like, I don't know what this is, but I keep seeing the trailer or the preview or teaser for it. I'm like, what the fuck is Mr. Robot? And they released that first coffee shop scene online, and I watch it, and the first fucking thing I did was call Ryan and be like, hey man, you gotta watch this and call me back. Like, tell me, I was like, this is something, right? Like, there's something here. And he did. He said, okay, I'll call you back. And he watched it, and he was like, that's fucking incredible. I was like, yeah, I don't know who this guy is. Like, I knew who Rami Malek was. Just like, oh, that's the kid from Night at the Museum. That's all I knew.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know who Sam Esmail is. I've never heard of this guy. But this show's coming on USA. And, I don't know. There's something here, man. And I think we should talk about it. And, you know. But as annoying as it was, like, I needed him to tell me, yes, there's something here. Because, like, I knew, like, because he was like that. So he was the kind of guy that would go, like, again, annoying as shit. He would walk to the gas station from, like, take a 15-minute break at work, walk to the gas station that was, like, in the parking lot across the street, buy a $20 scratcher, come back in and be like, hey, I won $300. And then be like, I'm going to go buy a scratcher. And you buy a scratcher and be like, well, I just wasted $20. You know, like every single time, you know, he'd buy a pack of baseball cards and be like, look, I got this one of one, like Freddie Freeman printing plate. And you're like, I'm going to go buy some baseball cards. And you're like, I didn't get shit. I didn't even get a ball player that I know. Like,
he was
just like that.
Yep.
Very, very annoying.
I was only a little part. Like, I only saw a little part of his life, you know. And then that was what I saw, and it was just like, damn. Like, how do you do this? Like, how do you have that kind of
it's a weird level. Midas touch. Like, your life is not like charmed by any way, shape or form, but like, you just have this weird Midas touch of like, I like this band. And then, you know, 3 months later or 6 months later, they're the biggest band in the world. You know, just crap like that. You know, and I mean, you know, it's definitely missed. Anyway, I didn't mean to turn it all melancholy.
No, it's all good.
I haven't been watching anything else. Just catching up on the stuff that I don't get to watch during the week now, because my afternoons are mostly, you know, walking the dog, so I don't get to sit around and watch TV.
No, absolutely. I haven't done a lot of watching. I mean, I'm like, I think that we've talked about this before, but like, I'm a huge food competition guy.
Yeah.
And so like, me and my wife have discovered Guy Fieri's Tournament of Champions.
I saw the trailer for that.
holy shit. Like, so we went back, like, you know, like with anything, like, right? Like, it, all roads lead back to HBO Max because they have all of the Food Channel stuff. So, like, we kind of dip and slide into those shows, right? And so, like, I'm, you know, I'm a Triple D fan. I mean, Guy Fieri forever. But I had no idea, like, how much Guy Fieri, like, how much it's been unlocked by the Food Network, that what is Guy Fieri's, like empire, right? And Tournament of Champions is kind of that, which it's kind of like Secret War. Like, the best way to describe it is it's Secret Wars meets the Avengers in, like, this weird competition show where all of the best chefs in the world, or the ones that have, like, you know, decided to do competition shows, compete in a 32 player bracket, like, against each other with blind judging of their food dishes. So, like they have, like, Nancy Silverton, Ming Tsai, like, these really, like, pillars of the food world, right? Of, like, the Michelin star food world, as judges, and they don't know whose food they're eating. They're just judging it based off the food. Man, this fucking competition show, like, each episode is 90 minutes because they do, like, four mini rounds. Like, they do four rounds of the round of 32, Sweet 16, 8, Final Four, you know, all that stuff, right? But I will tell you, dude, like, some of the shit is, like, wild. Like, it's like, it's the best of wrestling with NCAA bracket tournaments, but food. So, like, if you're into, like, if you're into food, you're probably already watching this, or competition shows. I have not seen this before. And it has, like, some of my favorite chefs on it competing. But it also has unlocked other shows, like Guy's Grocery, God damn it, what's the, I can't think of the whole name of it. But, like, Guy's Grocery Stores, like, you know, I mean, of course, I'm an Iron Chef fan, you know, Chopped. Like, all these other shows, like, that are on Food Network, like, that have stars on them, are competing in this Tournament of Champions. And it's just, dude, I fucking love it. Like, I'm, like I said, like, I'm a huge food competition show guy. I don't normally talk about it just because it's like, yes, it's pop culture, but it's so, I feel like what we do and what that is, it's kind of an adjacent thing. And we kind of got into it because of the fact that sometimes you need a refresh. Sometimes you don't want to watch a narrative, but I don't want to watch a dating show. Like, you know, I'm like, secret, like, my wife made me watch The Golden Bachelor, and, you know, she's a part of Bachelor Nation now. That's a whole other discussion. But I mean, I'm not a person that's, like, into that. And, like, you know, oftentimes, like, you know, sports stuff doesn't, like, you know, football doesn't happen only on Sunday and Monday, right? Maybe Thursdays. Basketball is starting to heat up, but we need a refresher. Like, I don't know about you, Logan. I don't know how you feel about things, but, like, oftentimes, like, sometimes, like, a narrative, like, narrative stuff, I need a refresh from, just to come back to it, to be excited. And the food competition stuff for us is, like, a big thing because we're also foodies. We also love to eat, and it gives us ideas of, like, how to approach food. And, you know, it just, it's kind of great. So, like, you know, that's what I've been watching is Tournament of Champions. You know, other than my normal stuff, I did not get to the Bad Batch. Did you watch Bad Batch?
I haven't watched this week's episode yet. I didn't get a chance to. So I was going to watch it last night, but it was like 1:30 and I was like, I got to go to bed.
Yeah, me too. Like, I just haven't had the chance to watch it. Thankful, like, we're actually getting two Abbott episodes next week, I should say. We're getting the post-Oscars one, and then we're getting another one on Thursday. So yeah, that should be exciting, because, you know, that's awesome. Are you watching Ghosts?
All right. So I know you enjoy it.
Yes.
I tried.
Okay.
A good friend of mine, Courtney, she's really into it, and I was over at her house, and she was like, have you seen this show? I was like, no, my buddy Adam talks about it all the time. I just haven't watched it. And she was like, oh, you got to watch it. And we watched, like, the first two episodes. She loves it. And I'm not knocking it, but I was just like, I don't think this is for me. Like, I see what they're going for. I just couldn't get into it. So,
okay. No, I mean, there's nothing. Look, I know, like, it is one of the, like, it's very much like a hangout show, like, where come for, it's very much like Abbott, right? Like, Abbott, there's storylines, but they're so loose, but you come for the characters, right?
Yeah.
Like, I go to Abbott or shows like that for the characters. So if you don't like the characters, or you don't like where it's going, then it's all, like, you know, again, like,
That I didn't find a single character that I was like, oh, I like this character. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, like, attached myself to.
And no, absolutely.
So I was just like, yeah, I mean, it's cute, but, like, I guess it's just not for me. I mean, maybe if I kept going, I might find something. But part of me wonders, like, I wonder how I'd think about, like, I might try the British Ghosts. To see if I like it a little bit better. Okay. She watched The British Ghost and hated it, but she was like, I don't understand what they're talking about. So.
It's good. It's not like the flavor of it is the difference between the American Office and the British Office. There's a lot more meanness in the UK Ghosts, like real meanness. Like, you know, like how like The Office in the UK was super mean. And that's part of the reason that kept it at a distance, even though there are certain, like, you know, it was lauded by everybody. But then audiences didn't truly latch onto it as per watching the first season of The Office. And you see how mean it is and you see how judgy it is. And as soon as they changed that and just let the characters like guide it and not the other way around, not guide the things with making embarrassing moments for characters and letting the characters do it themselves, how much of a change that was. Like, that's the difference in Ghosts, is like there's a mean streak in the UK version that's constant in their joking.
Yeah, I'd probably be way more in line with that.
Okay. Yeah, check it out then. Like, it might actually be the thing for you. Like, you know, and it's not to say that the other Ghosts, the American version of Ghosts, doesn't have that. I feel like it's one of those things where if you can invest in the first season, because like the first couple of like we watched the first 5 episodes together, and it wasn't until about episode 4 I started to really kind of like get hooked in, because they started to like figure out, like, because they have 22 episodes, right? So there's like a little bit more flow to the characters and you begin to really kind of understand the characters. And then we were watching it in like chunks like that, like 5 to 10 episode chunks, because it's 30 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Even though try to get my wife to watch Killers of the Flower Moon, which is the same length as 10 episodes of Ghost, and you know, there you go. It's never going to happen.
Like, I'll take the 10 episodes of Ghost.
Exactly. No, absolutely. You're 100% right. But yeah, okay. Well, I mean, you know, again, like, it's interesting for me to watch how certain things land with certain people. And it's kind of like a something that just came back this week, but it always makes me think of the last show that he was on, which is Eugene Levy's Reluctant Traveler came back, much to my surprise and delight. And I can't wait to dive into it, but it always makes me feel like, it's like whenever I see something between him or Catherine O'Hara, I always go back to, you know what, they're like Schitt's Creek. There's like 3 seasons that they left on the table, but I'm glad that they didn't take it, because I would rather miss that show in its glory. Even though there are a lot of people that don't like that show, they watch it and they go, "That this is not fucking for me. I fucking hate that show."
That was me. I watched 2 episodes and I was like, I don't know if this is for me, but like I've heard so many people say, no, like you got to get to like, you know, give it more of a chance. But I never went back to it. So.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Right. Like for me, it's like as soon like it was like the Bianca, like once they got like, once you got Alpha out of season one to and got midway into season two, where Dan Levy's character comes out as gay, and it's not forcing hetero, like, versions of his relationship into the mix, and also they let certain characters just be who they are, it kind of soars, because it's like, it was too forced at the beginning, and I feel like Ghost at the beginning is trying to be too much like its UK counterpart, but it's forcing it, so it's being kind of weird. But once you get to that point, like in any TV show that's like an ensemble, you just have to wait for them to relax, right? It's like Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I often think about that one and Parks and Rec as like the standards of like these kinds of shows, which all come from Barney Miller, right? Like, you know, let's be honest here. Barney Miller was that, and Taxi were the standards for work time, workplace comedies, situation comedies. But it's weird to watch how Brooklyn Nine-Nine just instantly got into that mode of like, within the first four episodes, they became the show that they were destined to become. They just got bigger and bigger as seasons went.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't mind when people, like, it means that it's doing its job, right? When it's not for somebody, it means that it's doing its job being unique. Because, you know, I respect The Office. I've seen The Office a couple of times, which I know that sounds weird if I'm wasting, like, I'm not going to call it a waste of time, but I'm not a rabid fan as much as other people are. Like, oh, yeah,
The Office I could watch endlessly.
Yeah, endlessly. You see, like, I'm like that with Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Like, I could watch that on a continuous loop, and that's my work time. Like that was, like, the thing, right? It's like, honestly, I feel like this is the best way to put it. It's like, there are two types of people in this world. There are people that are Cheers fans, and there's people that are Frasier fans. They're both made from the same people within the same universe, but some people prefer Cheers more than they prefer Frasier, and some people prefer Frasier more than Cheers, and neither one of them are wrong. It's just what your tastes are, right? You know? Like, you know, I'm a Cheers fan. Like, regardless of the fact
that I'm a Frasier guy.
If you're a Frasier, I know that, right? But the thing is that we can both appreciate the other show, right?
Oh, yeah, for like, sure. Within, Cheers has a lot. Like, Cheers is great. It's just, like, if you're telling me you can watch Cheers or Frasier, it's like, oh, I'm going to watch Frasier.
Oh, I know you are. Like, that's the whole thing. Is like, and then you know, if I'm going to watch Cheers or Frasier, I'm going to watch Cheers, right? Like, and that's, and you know what the funniest part is this is coming from a guy who does not like anything Boston-based. But I love Cheers. That tells you how much Cheers has affected my life, is that, like, regardless of whether or not it's set in Boston or not, and that Sam Malone is a ex-Boston, like, you know, Boston Red Sox pitcher, which, fucking, fuck that. It's still, like, one of my favorite shows, and it's still, like, the show, like, if I'm going to watch one, I'm going to watch that one. But I think we both agree, like, of everything, Seinfeld is king.
Oh, yeah. Like, that's, you know, every time I'm like, I'm not going to watch Seinfeld again, and then I'm like, I don't know what I want to watch. I guess I'll put on Seinfeld. I'm immediately, like, that's another just endless watch for me. Like, just, okay, well, rewind it, like, back from the jump. Let's start at one, go again, you know.
Okay, I'm gonna throw some things at you before we go out, just like little bits, see where you fall. Did you see the Inside Out 2 trailer?
I did. I mean, it looks great. It looks like another emotional roller coaster. It's just, I don't know if I want to stand in line for it, you know?
Fair enough. Yeah. No, absolutely. My wife is going to drive me to this because, like, Inside Out, the first one was, like, one of her favorites. And, like, I like the conceit. I like the conceit that the bad guy is anxiety. Like, like, it makes it very much so, like anxiety is going to put them away, right? Like, I mean, as a guy who deals with, like, who's been clinically diagnosed as having anxiety, like, the weird part is that, like, when I watched that trailer, I was like, you know, fuck, like, this is Pixar. This is what Pixar 2.0 should be, right? Like, when you make a sequel, it's not just to make a fucking sequel. It's having meaningful things to say about a topic. Even though I know that, like, people think, oh, well, Pixar is just Pixar. No, it's not. Like, they should be living up to a Miyazaki standard of things, which they have not recently. And it's nice to see them, like, push this trailer in a way that says, we're back. We are back. We, like, you know, we know that we...
That's why I'm not sure if I want to take the ride, because I'm just like, man.
Like, dude. Bing bong?
It's going to be something. Dude, you can't say those words.
I fucking, like, I'm getting all emotional, like, just thinking about it. Like, bing bong, like, man, that was a rough... Like, but that's... Okay, so, like, to me, I feel like that is the beauty of Pixar, is that they assassinate you with emotion.
Yeah.
Right? Like, a great Pixar movie there will be a moment that will be like, let's be honest, it's brazenly emotionally manipulative, but they've embedded it so well inside of the movie that you'd have to be literally a psychopath to not right. like feel something.
Right.
And I feel like Inside Out was the last one for me that really like sucker punched me. Because, like, what's the one with Jamie Foxx, which I find beautiful. Like, I love the Soul. There we go.
Yeah, I didn't see Soul.
I know that.
I haven't seen Soul. I haven't seen Upward. There's a lot of the last 10 years I haven't watched.
Soul is worth it if you're a Nine Inch Nails fan, it's amazing to hear Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor's score. Like, their score is so unexpectedly brilliant for that movie. But it's also just a visual treat. And it's also, like, it's not... The problem with Soul for me is that it didn't... The moment that should be the emotional devastation is not emotionally devastating for me. Though everything else with that movie works. And I honestly think it's because... This was the one that was pandemic, right? This is the one that did not get released in theaters. It went straight to Disney Plus, and it was the only one that didn't do theatrical, and we couldn't experience it theatrically. Because every other one that I've had that were like experiences like that, it'd always been in the theater, and it was kind of like this high of emotionality, but it just wasn't there for Soul for me. So it's beautiful, it's wonderful, it's accomplished. It's everything that you want a Pixar movie to be, except for that moment of, like, you know, that devastating dagger into your heart. But I am ready for it. I was wondering if you would, like, what your thought was. And in true Logan fashion, like, I felt like that might have been the case, but I wasn't 100%
sure. I mean,
sure.
I will probably go.
Yeah. And again, cry your fucking eyes out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's like, I'm not sure if I'm, you know, ready for that level of emotion. Because it's been quite... Sorry, I was pulling up the list. I guess I've seen more than I thought. I never saw Coco. I never saw The Good Dinosaur. Mm-hmm. I never saw Soul, Onward, or Luca, and I haven't seen Lightyear, but I did see Turning Red, which I think is great, and Elemental, Turning which Red. I thought was okay, and I honestly forgot about The Incredibles 2. I actually really, really loved The Incredibles 2 and Toy Story 4, even though I know they made money, but people were... like kind of down on them as sequels, but I really liked both of them.
Yeah, I did too. I find it weird that they're going to have a, like, they keep on saying like, this is the end. And I still feel like part of my not truly loving Toy Story 4 is the fact that Toy Story 3 is such a hard, it hits hard. Like in that final moment, like when you're watching the toys almost die, like that hit me harder than anything. And then, like, you know, Andy saying goodbye to the toys, like that was an end of an era, and that should have been the ending. Though I will say Toy Story 4 is brilliant in the way that it approaches things. It just, like, if there's a period at the end, it's a period for me. And if you continue to go on, it lessens that period, right? Like it makes it a comma, which isn't necessarily what you want. I would tell you to stay away from Onward, like there's nobody's business, because it's a story about brothers.
Yeah.
Like you would just,
that's why I haven't watched it. So like the Onward story is that movie came out the week of Ryan and I's birthday that year. That was in 2020. It was coming out that week. That's the week that everything shut down.
Things shut down. That's right.
And so we didn't see it. Like we just didn't make it to the theater to see it. Ryan eventually saw it and told me he really enjoyed it. Cause it was one of the early, like, oh, we're just going to dump it on Disney Plus now. And he was like, oh, it's really good. And I just never got around to watching it. And then by the end of 2020, he had passed away. And I was like, I don't know if I can ever watch this movie. So
I mean, like, just to give you an idea, like when I finally did get to see it, like it was after Ryan had passed, like I had not seen it on Disney Plus. It looked entertaining. I just never got around to it because the pandemic. But then when I saw it, like the only thing I could think about was you and Ryan, like literally, like the way that it plays out, the, like, you know, the relationship, I was just like, I can't deal with it. Like even I couldn't deal with it. So like I could totally understand, like, not being a thing at all. But another thing that I wanted to ask you about, did you see, like, because we're both childs of the 80s and like I can only imagine that you're probably as excited as I am. Thank You, Good Night, the Bon Jovi story. Did you see the trailer for this fucking shit?
No.
Oh my God, dude, this fucking, like, it's exactly what you expect from one of these miniseries documentaries. Like, it's flashy, it's glitzy, it looks exactly like you want to see this. Like, I guarantee you, if you see the trailer, you will want to see this just because it is exactly what you expect from the Bon Jovi story documentary. It's like, I can't wait for just to hear what your thoughts are on this one. It's like, the more, like, when I watched it, you know what I thought about? Like, you know who Bon Jovi looks like in his heyday? He literally looks like Mark Wahlberg from Rockstar. Like, literally, why the fuck did they make Rockstar? Why didn't they make the Bon Jovi story? Because it would have been a hell of a lot more entertaining than the Midnight Oil story, where they recasted their guy. Like, just make the Bon Jovi story because you look just like him. The last one I want to ask you about is adjacent to another quick question. Go ahead. Hold
on. The Bon Jovi thing. So, I'm going to at least watch part of it because I want to know if they include this. Do you know what the first thing John Bon Jovi was ever involved in, like, recording-wise? Like, his very first, like, on-record, like, music thing. It's so fucking weird. All right, so his uncle was like a producer. I think it's his uncle. And he was working on a Star Wars Christmas album that was basically just like holiday songs and like new, like, made up shit. It would have been the late 70s, early 80s. With Anthony Daniels and, of course, R2-D2's little beeping noises. Yeah. And they needed some musicians. So I'm pretty sure it's his uncle called him and was like, hey, I need somebody, like, I need a studio musician, like, for this. Like, do you want to come down for this? So in the Star Wars holiday album or whatever it's called, I think it's a Star Wars Christmas or something like that. In the, like, liner notes, in the credits, John Bon Jovi is credited as like one of the studio musicians.
Oh man, that's great. Well, okay, so side note about this, it probably is going to happen because do you know who produced it? Hulu Disney.
Okay, yeah.
So very much so. I hope mean, that's like, in you there. Can still I mean, it's like a 6-part documentary. So I can only imagine that the origins are going to be there, and I mean, that's too delicious of a notion to not put in there, right? Like that's amazing. Like the fact that that's what he, like, that was one of his first things that he ever started, started with. But I know that it does, like, the weird thing is that it's framed with their comeback tour and his cancer scare. Like, I don't know if you knew about that.
Yeah. I've heard about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, it's literally, that's what's framing it. That's what the documentary is framed against, like, you know, very similar to, like, you know, like most of these kinds of documentaries where they frame it against, they make the context about something that's either current or something that happened that was a major event, and that's what they're doing. But it looks like, I mean, you know, of course, like any good 80s rock band, it like looks like here's a big thing. I am not a fan of the rock drama. Like, you know, like the fiction, like the fictional version. I love the documentaries of these things, right? Like, if you're gonna do, like, you know, the John Bon Jovi story or the Bon Jovi story, I don't know if I want it casted with a bunch of young guys with, like, hair. Like, I'd rather have the documentary where I can see the footage, because all these idiots, all they did was take video footage. So there's like ton of video footage, like starting in the 80s with these kinds of bands. That's what I like. I don't care too much for the, you know, let's make a, okay. So like one of my favorite books, like not like one of my favorite biographies is it, even though I'm not a big fan of them, the Motley Crue one, but what do? You don't make a documentary about it, which is the way that I would want it. You make the movie or the TV series, and it's just terrible. Like, I watched it and I'm like, what? You did all of this? I waited all this time for this, where it's like the documentary is the way to go, at least to me. I always feel like these good multi-part documentaries are like the best way to approach it. It's like the Jordan thing. It's like, how do you cast Michael Jordan? Yeah. You can't. You do the documentary. It's like, how do you cast Bon Jovi? Like, who do you cast as Bon Jovi? Timothy Chalamet? No. Austin Butler? No. You fucking make a documentary about it. It's coming like at the end of April.
So I just looked it up just to make sure I wasn't too far off base. So it came out before it was before The Empire Strikes Back. So it was in 79. Here's the little tidbit. The album is notable. It's called Christmas in the Stars, A Star Wars Christmas. The album is notable for featuring the first professional recording of John Bon Jovi, credited as John Bon Jovi, who also sang lead vocals on the song R2-D2, We Wish You a Merry Christmas. His cousin, Tony Bon Jovi, cousin, not uncle, co-produced the album and ran the recording studio where it was recorded, where John was working sweeping floors at the time.
Oh, shit. That's great. Oh, God, it has to be in there. I will let you know, because I'm going to watch it. I'm going to watch at least the first episode. And you know, like, first episode has to be about that, right? Because it's childhood, growing up, your first break. Like, I mean, these things are cliches, but, I mean, you know, there's cliches for a reason, right? Because they fucking work.
And I'll also say, I've listened to the album. It's goofy, but, like, yeah. there's some stuff in there that, like, there's a song called What Do You Get a Wookiee for Christmas When He Already Owns a Comb? And like, it's kitschy, but, like, you know, it's one of those, like, what if I found it on vinyl, I'd be like, oh, fuck yes, I'm buying this. I may give it a shot, so.
Well, why don't I do this? Why don't we do this? Why don't I watch the first episode, and I'll report back to you, and if they do have the Star Wars-esque of it all, I'll just give you a thumbs up. Bon Jovi, thumbs up. So you can watch the first episode and see what you think.
Okay, cool.
save you hours and hours of time and heartache and pain and just frustration. The next thing that I wanted to talk to you about, and I guess we can close on this because it kind of leads to another question I have for you. Have you watched the Fallout trailer?
Yes.
Thoughts on it?
I mean,
the new one that just came out. The one that just came out yesterday, I think it was, or the day before.
It looks interesting. I mean, I'm probably gonna watch it. I may have played one Fallout game and not even the whole game. So I'm excited for the people that are excited for it, but like, it's not my thing. And also, like, I'm still happy. Like, I still think we're in this golden age of video game adaptation things. But like, the second season of Halo also dropped about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I tried to watch it. As much as I did not like season one, I was like, I'm gonna give it a shot. And I'm just like it's so disheartening to me that like I'm having trouble getting myself psyched up for a video game adaptation. Even though we've talked about it, like there have been so many good ones in the last like 12 to 14 months, even on TV, you know,
Twisted
Metal was really fucking good.
Yeah. So, even though they fucking kill a dog, it's still a good adaptation, you know? I was just wondering, cause like I've played Fallout. It has the attitude of a Fallout game. It really does. Like, it really feels like it has the violence. But what I'm interested in is the cast and the writing of it. Like, I'm truly interested because it's like, I mean, I think we've been on record as saying, like, you know, Baby Billy's Bible Bonkers is like, you know, I mean, Walton Goggins is like, you know, I will follow him.
National treasure, man.
Yes, he really is. Like, and then also, like, I'm not gonna lie, like, Jonathan Nolan, like, his Westworld, like, I don't know if you got to see Westworld.
Yeah, I didn't watch Westworld. By the time season two finished, I was like, I'm gonna watch this show. People were like, don't watch this show. So I was just like, okay. And then it was watch it, don't watch it, watch it. Then I was like, I'm not gonna fucking watch it, guys.
It definitely like it definitely had a flavor, and it definitely went like in unexpected directions. So like, I'm interested what he's going to do with the Fallout series, because it has so many of the tropes that I love, right? Like, I love post-apocalyptic, but I also love like the randy attitude that like gets going in certain ones. Like in the certain adaptations or like, you know, certain post-apocalyptic things. And this has the attitude that I love. Like, you know, it's like you cast Walton Goggins as a dude with no nose. That's like a star in the, but that's like a lone ranger-esque, like hero, of the apocalypse. Right. Like, you can't get any better than that. Like, the only way that you get better is that you fucking, you cast, like, I don't even know. You can't even get any better than that. That's just so super awesome. I love it. Like, Kyle MacLachlan's in it. Like, and I mean, I love Kyle MacLachlan. It's big. It looks big. It looks, like, big in a way that I feel like a lot of movies or like a lot of TV shows have not been recently. Like, it literally looks like it cost $500 million. Like, you remember how like they were talking about how like Lord of the Rings cost like $500 million, like the TV show. And I watched it and I went, I don't see it. Like, I watched the first two episodes and I'm like, and the first two episodes are usually the flashiest, right?
Yeah, it gets a lot flashier as it goes.
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And then it also leads me to this question of like, you know, you were talking about video games, like your, you know, how's your PS5 experience going? Like,
I'm glad you brought it up. So I did get through, Spider-Man's the only thing I'm playing on PS5.
Yeah.
I did get through the Coney Island stuff.
Okay.
I thought that was pretty interesting. This, like, circus full of old, like, Spider-Man villains.
Yes, right? Like, it's kind of fucking great. Like, and then you got, so that you got all of the Mysteriums unlocked then.
Yeah, that's all I've done. So, I haven't, whatever, like, there's a bit, so you get there and you're walking around as, like, Peter, with MJ and Harry, and, you know, doing all the carnival games, and then there's a big fight, and, you see, spoilers for Spider-Man 2, you see Harry has been infused with, the symbiote. And he's, you know, he's not Venom, but, like, obviously that's where they're headed. And so that's where I'm at, like, post that fight. So,
okay.
Like, I'm right there.
If you can go, if you, like, so when you're in Coney Island, like, if you switch over to Miles, the Miles section is about Mysterio, because Mysterio is one of his villains.
Okay.
So he go, like, you go into the Mysterium, like, so Mysterio has gotten out of prison and he's starting a new venture. He with some venture capitalists, people that are doing augmented reality, but the augmented reality of what Mysterio was using. Like, so, but the concept is that you have to go in to save him because his psychotropic drugs and all the VR screens have gone wild and have captured him and a person inside one of the first guests he has. And so you're inside of Mysterio's Mysteriums, and all of the weird, like, the only way I can put it is the Inception style dreamland that he has concocted. You play in, and you have to defeat in a certain time in order to save the person and also save Mysterio.
Yeah. So it's kind of more of like, so in this game, when you first meet, like, Miles goes into it, and then you play the, like, where it breaks down.
And yes.
Like the DJ, you have to do the DJ thing, which was
frustrating.
Time button mashes frustrate the shit out of me, but I got the hang of it. So it's like, it's an extension of that, because, like, after that, the ride's, quote, broken down, and you can't access it, so you can go back and do stuff with Miles there. Okay, because, like, yeah, it goes from Miles' story to Peter's story. I'm like, why did Miles have to activate this mission? Because now I'm just walking around as Peter. What was the point of this? Of course, the point is, you know, Harry's Venom, but I knew that already. So,
like, it starts that, and you have, like, and, you know, like, you have the unlocked missions all throughout New York where you can go to the different VR stations and help out. And the nice thing is, and this is what I love about a game that goes extra, is that each of the Mysteriums require a different skill set. So it's not like you're replaying all of the mission in the same thing over and over again. Each one has a different, like, goal or skill set that you have to use. So it's truly, like, it's a lot of fun. I'm glad that you were able to, like, make some more progress with it.
It's probably, I'm going to eat lunch when we're done and probably play some Spider-Man, so.
Absolutely. And then they just brought out an update, which is interesting. Like, it's interesting that they brought out an update. They have a new game plus, and here's the shitty part, is that the costumes and the little unlocked things, like, have you heard about this action figure mode?
No.
Okay, so you can go into this action figure mode, and if you go into the action figure mode, it actually makes you the size of an action figure so that you can, like, take a picture. You could do anything you want. Like, it's kind of funny. Like, I was reading about it, and I'm like, oh, I want to do that. But it's only available in the Game Plus. And also the new suits are only available in the Game Plus. And I'm not a Game Plus fan. I don't like having to replay something over again. Yeah. But I will say this much. Like, this is the one time where I may actually want to play the Game Plus. Just because it has those things to unlock. I'm like, I might do this just to get the suits, because I'm that much of a Spider-Man fan, or Insomniac Spider-Man, Spider-Man in general too. So, okay, I'm actually excited to hear more from you as you play on, because I feel like the game gets better as you move forward.
It's definitely, I'm definitely in a groove with it now, where mm-hmm. I was a little frustrated with some of the control stuff at the beginning, but it's become kind of sort of second nature, like, yes, combos for the fighting. I don't get killed as much in the fights as I did.
Well, okay, so like, I was going to ask you about that now that you've had a chance to kind of like understand the vibe of it. I find that, like, I found, like, and I didn't even find this in game tutorials, but I found that the more you do combos, the easier it is to combat all of the different people that you're facing. Like, the combat engine here, before it used to be button mashing, but this is a little bit more like, I know it sounds weird, but it really feels like the combat engine went Mortal Kombat adjacent, where you have to use combos, you have to use blocks, you have to use certain skill sets that were never a thing.
Especially for the fights that, like, when you're fighting Kraven's guys, because they will just overwhelm you. Like, are the firebombing people, like, that?
Yeah, the fire cult.
Yeah, it'll overwhelm you, because, like, there'll be two or three dudes with flamethrowers, and you're just like, what the fuck? Like, every time I turn around, somebody's shooting me with a flamethrower. So, yeah, it kind of is forcing you to get a little more finessed and not just smash all the buttons until all the bad guys are dead, which I can appreciate, but, like, you can also lower the level of, you know, make it a little easier on you. I didn't do that, but, you know, I'm sure that helps if people like me who are like, I'm not real good at combos.
It doesn't. So, I'll tell you, it doesn't, because I changed the level and it's still the same requirement. Okay. Like, and that's the thing, is that I feel like that's the thing that people should know about this game. Is, like, and I hadn't even thought about it until you started telling me, man, I'm dying, like, with all these, like, if there's too many people, and I was like, oh, shit, I forgot that it's, like, and also, I started playing again, like, just doing the vibe thing, because I'm finished with the game, so I played a little yesterday, and the thing that fucking shook me was, like, I was like, oh, yeah, that's right, combos in defensive style, like, you know, making sure that you're jumping all the time to move away from these people, which can kind of get annoying. But I was also going to tell you, I know the Firebrand seems like a weird kind of offshoot. There's a whole storyline that you go on that I found was, like, one of the best subplots in the entire game. Like, where it goes, if you can early on, if you find, because of course, like, you know, a lot of the game is traversing the city and going on missions and then unlocking other things. If you find the fire cult unlock, and it's a very specific thing, and you will know who it, you will know because there's a character that helps you with it, go with it, because it's actually a really interesting subplot that is worthwhile. I mean, I know that you'll eventually get to it, but if you do find it, like, I always tell, like I tell people that have started playing that game, go with that storyline, because it's a lot of fun. It's also very different, and it has a lot of fun combat and hide and seek, if you're into the hide, which I know that is a big thing with the Kraven stuff, is, like, the hide and seek, which some people did not like. I liked.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't too much about the game I haven't liked outside of the some of the gameplay stuff itself, like the variety of the types of like missions and stuff, I really have enjoyed. Like, okay. It doesn't feel as cookie cutter as some of the stuff in the first game felt, where it's just like, yes. Oh yeah, you know, like the chases are a little cookie cutter here, but like everyone is just kind of the same so far. But you know, other than that, like I've not ran into anything I didn't. And who doesn't love just swinging around the city? So
seriously. Oh, the update also allows you to do change your time frame or change your time of day.
Like, oh, I know that that's nice. I greatly love that.
Yeah, because to be perfectly honest, like my favorite time to run around is at night.
Me
so,
too. Like, anytime it's nighttime, I'm like, oh, I love this. It's so great. So, yeah. Cool. Yeah. We'll check back in next week and see where I'm at. So, we'll go check out everything else we're doing over at x1files.com. And if you want to read some of my writing, more of which is coming soon, I'm almost done with the next one. Go check out Adam's website.
Yes. Yeah, we are waiting for Logan with that next piece, just so, because everything was locked and loaded. We just like to have three or so in a row so that it can be like a month and a half of Logan content. So we will be having that as soon as he gets us that other one and we can razzle dazzle it. You can read my work there, movieall.com. I've got a lot of reviews up right now, home video stuff. Getting to go deep dive into like classic Hollywood stuff, which is super awesome.
Yeah. I've noticed that. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. It's been a lot of fun. Being able to do that because I don't have a master to answer to. Just wherever my review, wherever the home video content takes me. And then also occasionally the occasional movie, movie review. That's just straight up movie. Not a Blu-ray disc or 4K, but yeah, you can read that there. Marie actually is coming back also, so like, you know, people that love her work, just be on the lookout. Sometime this week we'll be having some stuff from her from across the pond, which is always fun. We'll be back next week. I think I'm gonna try to go see Kung Fu Panda. I think I want to see that. So if you're down with that, maybe we can do something about Kung Fu Panda since it's.
I don't think I've seen one since the second one.
Yeah, that's what me and my wife were talking about. We were like, she's like, I saw the first one, and she goes, and then after that, it gets really fuzzy, and I'm like, you know what? They're on Peacock. Everybody's favorite streaming service. We'll watch them, and then we'll culminate it with a watch this week. This week of the movie. Like, I didn't want to go see it this weekend because the kid situation of it all.
Yeah.
Even though it's fun to watch, like it's fun to have the kid energy. Yeah, but
it can be like if they're really talkative, it's you're just like, oh my god, I can't do this. So, yeah. I may not. I just got Mutant Mayhem on Blu-ray, so I may try to rewatch that at some point because I still haven't seen it since I had my rough theater experience. So
I understand all too well. Like there's been really nothing that I've been watching in the theater. Like literally, like I haven't seen anything other than the review stuff, and even then, like Doom 2 was like literally a month ago. Like I'm already past this. I'm like, come on guys, let's get over the Doom 2 stuff.
Like yeah been there, done that.
Yeah, been there, done that. Still like the Lynch version. Is it like one weird question, is it really weird to you that social media is fucking flipping out over this movie, invoking Empire?
I feel like I don't have a right to say anything because I haven't seen it. But yeah, mm-hmm. I'm like, it can't be that good.
Like, it's not.
But yeah, people are losing their minds. Like everybody's just like, it's like the pinnacle. It's going to save cinema. I'm like, okay, whatever. I probably won't ever watch it. So, but yeah, go check out all those things, and we will see you guys next week.
See you next week.
And the Hobbit, number 4 Mario, number 5 Weird Al, number 6 Batman, number 7 Kal-El, number 8 The Simpsons, number 9 TV, number 10 every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but they're really all sold out. Say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds.